From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Grumpy Cat, Harlem Shake, planking, and wailing. These are trends that are new, obviously, but in a bigger sense, they're not really. The folklorist Lynn McNeil says we've always done stuff like this, taken the tidbits of popular culture and put our own spin on them. The internet is faster and bigger for sure, but it's just another medium to be funny or nasty or generous. Today in the program, we're talking about the kind of culture we're creating online. For those who say technology is dehumanizing, Lynn McNeil has another way of looking at it. All these cat videos and goofy lingo and absurd memes, that's all created by us, she says, and it shows just how human the internet can be. We invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So what if those of us who have sat around at dinner parties tut-tutting about what digital culture is doing to human civilization, what if we're just expressing a frustration of being out of our element? The folklorist Lynn McNeil says that the online world of hashtags and memes and trends like planking and wailing and puppies going down staircases, that's a culture. And like any culture, you've got your natives and you've got your non-natives, your digital immigrants, as she puts it. Maybe those of us wringing our hands about the internet haven't really oriented ourselves just yet, haven't worked out the language, because there is a language there, of course. Today in the program, we're talking about the internet as a culture and how we use it to express ourselves, to communicate, to entertain that vast audience glued to the screen. Lynn McNeil is back with us. She teaches folklore at Utah State University. Her work focuses on legends and belief. She's the author of Folklore Rules and has contributed chapters to books on digital folklore. And Lynn McNeil, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Trevor Blank is also with us, a folklorist. He teaches at the State University of New York at Potsdam. His books include Folklore and the Internet. Most recently, his book, The Last Laugh. He's joining us from North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York. And Trevor Blank, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start, Lynn, and I warned you about this. I want to have you start with this story that you tell in a chapter that you wrote for a book about your husband and deviled eggs, because it's such a telling story.
It really is. And this is actually in one of Trevor's books,
right,
Folklore
right.
on the Internet. And the story is that my husband at the time was working as a graphic designer, so he was on a computer all day long. And, you know, much of our downtime these days is also on a computer, so it really was all day long. And we were going to a party, and we were preparing deviled eggs, a notoriously slippery food. And he was lifting the plate, and the eggs, it was one of those inevitable moments where you sort of see it in slow motion, the eggs begin to slide and they begin to fall off and go all over the floor. And he sort of, in his frustrated moment, the word that comes out is not a curse word or anything bad, it's Control Z, which is, for those, you know, who use computers a lot will know, is the undo function. And I was sort of stunned and looked at him, and he looked back at me sort of blankly and said, I just wanted to undo it. You know, it was a mistake. And he, of course, spends all his day maybe drawing the wrong line on his drafting board and just hitting Control Z and that line disappears. And to me, it just showed how ingrained this other mode of interaction and creation and, you know, being is in our lives.
But you got it, right?
I mean, Oh yeah, I got it immediately. And I can relate. Sometimes as I'm falling asleep, as everyone does, and I'm thinking through my to-do list, I realize I'm thinking through it typed. Like I'm typing out the words in my brain as I'm thinking about what I need to do the next day, which is fascinating. You know, it's just that's a large part of how we not just communicate, but how we envision communicating.
Trevor Blank, is that a way of thinking about it? That I mentioned this in the introduction, that this is a language. This is a culture that has its own language, all of its own forms, much of which we'll talk about. But is that the way to best understand it? Like it's a language that some of us get, some of us may not yet.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the interesting things about digital culture in a lot of ways is how it's been adaptive to earlier forms of face-to-face interaction, where we've taken the ways that we've previously expressed ourselves and the different types of folklore that we've generated and have modified them to utilize these kind of new components in a very cyborg-like way we've adapted with these different kind of technologies and made them part of who we are. And it's interesting because we see this happening more and more, especially with younger generations that are coming up, to use the term digital native, as you mentioned in the introduction that Lynn has also mentioned before. One of the things about digital natives is that they are socialized into a world with this technology, which functionally changes the way that people learn to communicate and express themselves. And when you take into consideration the fact that in the United States, that as of Pew Internet Research data in 2011, which itself is somewhat dated by today's standards, the average age in which a child was getting their first cell phone was only 9.5 years old. And in single family households, it was even younger than that. And its trajectory is going younger and younger. Something in the UK, something like a third of children under the age of 2 have access to a tablet. So this is functionally changing the way that people are learning to communicate and therefore by extension express themselves, which then changes and kind of fundamentally alters some of these preconceived notions we've had about folklore in orality and in oral traditions and things that we've observed before. So it's absolutely changing the way that we actually think about expressing. And I think Lynn's story kind of really speaks to that in a great deal.
I'm not sure how much time we'll spend with the qualitative question, the question about whether or not this is problematic. I mean, I guess what, Lynn, you're most interested in, Trevor, you too, is not necessarily whether this is a good thing or a bad thing for, me in air quotes here, civilization, but just that how it works, the fact that it takes forms like this.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the big things is that technology is not a divide from our humanity. It is a tool of our humanity. And that's something that we've seen all along the way. You know, there's a perception that of tradition, that it's somehow rigid or binding us to the past. And that's never been the case. Tradition has always been fluid and evolving and adaptive, as Trevor said. And it takes what tools are around and uses them for its ongoing modes of creation. You know, there's a perception that innovation and tradition are somehow opposed, and really they go hand in hand most of the time. So we see folklore that existed happily without communications technology merging into communications technology. Urban legends are now more shared on the internet than they are perhaps in, you know, face-to-face communication. And we see new forms of cultural expression showing up as well, simply because the tools are available. I think that's a wonderful statement about human creativity, is that whether we have, you know, the tools of nature, sticks and rocks, or whether we have, you know, Wi-Fi and cell phone networks, we're going to use what's available to perpetuate traditions and creatively express ourselves, which I think is great.
Because it's embedded in us.
Yeah.
Trevor, I wonder, how do you understand this inclination to resist technology, though? I mean, it seems like we always do. Is that part of human nature, too, to be resistant to maybe a foreign language, right? Or I mean, we're just naturally worried and suspicious about it, it seems.
I think it's natural to be suspicious of technology in some way, because what you're basically asking here, what we really see with technology and folk culture is really something that some folklorists refer to as hybridization, and that's this adaptation of these institutional products. Like technology, things that are made by corporations that have a business model that they're trying to succeed in, and then people are using those institutions for folk expression. And so there has to be some kind of a relationship between those two mediums in order for this kind of genuine folklore to surface and circulate prolifically. So there's a skepticism inherent to that process, because you have to rely on institutions in order to express yourself in the digital medium. And accordingly, I think this is where some skepticism has come within from other folklorists as well, is how can we be sure that this is a genuine tradition when an institution can influence the way that it's then perceived by other individuals? And really what we see is that people are finding ways to get around that. While there is absolutely this skepticism is inherent to the domain in a lot of ways because of technology, we're finding most interesting in types of folklore are the ones that try to work against that and get around that. But I certainly understand it, even for my own personal life. Most people are find it kind of humorous to note that I don't own a smartphone, even though I study digital folklore. I still have a basic phone that doesn't get on the internet and can barely take pictures and doesn't have a data plan. which seems very antithetical to exactly the kind of things that I study. But it's not because I'm necessarily suspicious of technology myself. It's because I have a very, very bad problem with attention deficit disorder, and I know that I won't be able to get anything done otherwise.
Well, but that does go to the question about the difference. In some ways, maybe, yeah, you're right. Maybe it's just another form, but there are things that are significantly different. And one of the things, Lynn McNeil, you've talked about, which sort of gets to those of us who have this kind of attention deficit problem with the internet, this idea that it's a perpetual motion of genres and memes, and they flare up for a moment, they burn for a while, then they sort of fade out, and things are always on the move. And that, I'm not sure if that's unique necessarily, but the dynamics here are pretty different in that sense.
You know, they are in some ways, largely because we're able to see that speed on a much, much bigger scale. We have, you know, we can have old memes that, you know, who knows about planking anymore? That's so 2012, 2013. But if you were to go on a computer now and Google planking, you'd find all the pictures there. They're not, that those cultural expressions aren't as ephemeral as speech, which, you know, disappears unless it's being recorded somehow. And I think what we see is absolutely a speeding up and an expansion of the traditional process, just lightning fast. A meme or a joke or a rumor or a legend can be around the globe within hours, minutes, probably even. And that certainly hasn't been possible without technology. And I think that can be frightening. I think that can be promising. Mm. We tend to see people's opinions fall to the two extremes. There are real utopian views about the internet. It's going to provide a voice for everybody. It's going to level the playing field. Suddenly the common people are able to broadcast just as much as those that own broadcasting companies and all of this stuff. And I think on the other side, we see a real dystopian view of these machines are controlling our lives and the very real reality that they're not available to everyone. It's hardly equalizing if you have to own a personal computer, have electricity, pay for a monthly account, all of those sorts of things. So we tend to see the extremes, and I think the reality is somewhere nicely in the middle. It is fast, it is rapid, it is broad, but that doesn't mean it's not genuine or useful or beneficial or anything like that. And I think the reality is that the traditions from the past, the things we think of when we think of folklore, Grimm's fairy tales, mm-hmm. you know, like old legends of haunted English buildings and castles and things, the stuff that rings true as folklore in most people's minds, was from a time of slower process, and we didn't retain all the trends that lasted a week from the 1800s in Germany or all
But they were there.
Oh, absolutely. We've always had this minutia of folk culture that just didn't get preserved as purposefully as the specific stories say that the Grimm brothers preserved. But it was always there. It's always been here. We're just able to recollect it better now through Google Archive.
Yeah, to go and find it. Trevor Blank, what do you think about that?
Well, I'd add that one of the things that we mentioned is that in addition to these kind of inability to always trace these kind of nuances in oral tradition, we've seen the same thing happen with the next kind of logical step, technologically speaking, between orality and the internet, and that's with print technology, for example. We have been able to see things show up in newspapers, for example, like instances of the Jersey Devil appearing in 1909. We were able to actually see that traced over a two-month period, and then it greatly fall off and then become a part of oral traditions as well. We can actually track that as well. But one of the interesting things I also think about the internet, and this kind of speaks to Lynn's point, is that despite the internet being often kind of skeptically viewed as possibly a means of killing off folklore in some aspects, is also the means for preserving it in the exact same ways that she's kind of outlined, that while it may seem ephemeral, it nevertheless is able to be archived in a very vibrant way as well. And again, this isn't necessarily anything new. This is just something in a new form that we're seeing. And one of these key characteristics of folklore studies that we often look for when we're trying to trace tradition over time is this concept of repetition and variation, which is that things repeat over time and they vary over time. So you can see how things morph. You can see how one thing starts from point A and gets to point B by way of these little changes. And we see that through digital technology to a great extent of these different forms of oral folklore and print folklore resurfacing in different ways. One of the most common examples now of folklore out there that's very vibrantly circulating is the story of the Slender Man, for example.
Yeah.
And the story of the Slender Man is this kind of creature, this supernatural creature who has no face, who's very tall, who snatches children, who doesn't show up in pictures until after the fact, or you don't see him until right before you die. There's been these other kind of correlations to previous folkloric traditions that have been incorporated into this internet genre, because this is primarily has been dispersed originally through the internet. That show this kind of strong correlation from older traditions, both oral and print related.
So what I think is interesting about that, I want to go back to that Jersey Devil example that you mentioned. So you've got the Jersey Devil that sort of emerges somewhere after the turn of the last century, right?
Yes.
And now, and maybe this is, I'm sure that we've moved past this, but it wasn't that long ago when you were constantly seeing the Chupacabra. Remember that?
Yeah.
Sure.
Is that just sort of the 21st century version of that in some way?
Well, I know Lynn can talk a bit more about cryptids, having worked on some Bigfoot stuff herself. But I can say it's something that actually stems from German folklore. The particular example of the Jersey Devil, the one I'm more familiar with is actually a Maryland one, because I'm originally from Maryland myself, called the Snallygaster, which actually showed up in newspapers about 2 or 3 weeks after the Jersey Devil did. So there's a kind of interesting correlation between there. You can see actually Jersey and Maryland are not too far apart.
Yeah.
And that's a dragon-like creature that takes all these kind of characteristics from established German folklore and brings them into a community of largely German descendants in that part of Maryland where it flourished, and tied into things of folklore that they previously existed, contextualized it into the Maryland present, mm-hmm. and then made this kind of residential boogeyman who just presided over the region. And so if you go to other parts of Maryland, for example, outside of the Frederick area where the Snallygaster is primarily from, people probably don't know who the Snallygaster is, or they associate the Snallygaster with more like a Bigfoot creature, which is kind of what it morphed into in the 1960s and 70s when that became popularized in the United States. So this is kind of a response in a great deal to contextual factors, things going on in the news. So the Snallygaster arrives because newspapers are failing, not getting enough people to pay attention, and the Jersey Devil selling a whole bunch of newspapers just a short ways across the way. You can see there are influences for bringing these kind of things into play that people then respond to and create diversions on and manifest all these different kind of characteristics about.
Yeah, I think that's – I think actually Trevor's just perfectly illustrated that major – quality of folklore, as he pointed out, that it's repetitive, it's traditional, it's not a brand new invention, it's someone taking something that's, you know, come from the past, but reinventing it, adapting it to a new context, whether that new context is Maryland versus Jersey or the internet versus face-to-face communication, yeah. Folklore is, by definition, adaptable culture. You know, a book gets published, everyone who reads it, that buys a copy, is going to read the exact same copy of that book, but an oral folktale, an urban legend, or a joke that gets told gets recreated each time it is reiterated. And that allows for someone to make it more relevant to them. And we see that that's really was one of the first ways folklore was identified online. You know, we have these internet memes, images with block text over them that circulate around. And what we find is often, you can even go now to different university pages, different universities will have the same meme tailored for their students,
sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And so there's BYU versions of the same meme that there's a USU version for or something like that. And that's the beauty of folklore, is that it's adaptable and we can watch those adaptations and understand how it's reflecting cultural change.
But you said something that was interesting, that it's about making it more relevant. It has to be relevant for us. I mean,
yeah.
And so that's why the Chupacabra videos are so interesting, because whether people were messing around or not, I suspect they were. The idea was to make it look, I mean, I have a video of this. It's absolutely
yeah.
real. Or I photoshopped this image. It absolutely is. So the idea of it being real is important for us, right?
Clearly. And I think the one thing to point out is that folklorists on the whole, and this is totally a cop out for a lot of people, is we aren't looking for, you know, the Chupacabra or Bigfoot or the Jersey Devil. That's not our job. Our job is to come in and say, why does everyone really want this to be true?
Yeah.
You know, what does that say about our society that we are so invested in the possibility that these things are true that we continue telling stories, we make videos. I think far more interesting than the creation of a video is the perpetuation of a video, because folk culture is not required. You know, you don't have to tell jokes that you hear. You don't have to forward internet memes. You don't have to pass on videos that you see. So if we do, if everyone collectively is choosing to perpetuate something, it must have a significance. Yeah. It might just be that it's fun. Yeah. That's enough of a significance sometimes. Yeah. Yeah. But it might be even more significant than that.
Well, it's interesting. Trevor Blank, you've talked about one of the elements of significance you've talked about is that it gives us, those of us who want to, you know, create these memes based on political or social events, it gives us a kind of a control. It gives us a power over the other figures, you know, the news, the media on one hand, or politicians or leaders on the other hand. Sure. We have control. It gives us power over the story, the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the other elements of folklore that's so powerful. And this is, I mean, in the early days of the internet, everyone kind of went the kind of utopian direction, like this is going to be the great thing that brings democracy to all people who can access the internet. But of course, it hasn't been that. But it has kind of helped not entirely change, but helped to level the playing field in how other people can participate in a larger discourse outside of just their own communities. It's made the world bigger for a lot of individuals. And so when it comes to major things happening, whether they be in popular culture or whether they be political or whether they be a tragedy or disaster, there's now a platform where everyone can be an expert, quote unquote, on any given thing.
Yeah.
And oftentimes this comes in the form of some type of expression. And this kind of goes right back to the point with what Lynn was just saying, is that we're looking for what is meaningful and why it is meaningful so we can have a better understanding of the present or where we've been or perhaps where we're even going, if I want to sound misty about it. But that's really kind of what we're kind of getting after with studying contemporary folklore, is seeing how people go past these boundaries to try to ascertain meaning in life from situations that seem meaningless or full of questions, like 9/11, for example.
Yeah.
That was one of the first major disasters, Challenger disasters, one of the very first major disasters to be widely covered by folklorists, and then 9/11 later, similarly.
Well, 9/11 brings up a question. This is something that, this is a meme that appeared pretty quickly, and it was this man standing on the balcony, or supposedly standing on the balcony of the World Trade Center, and you've all seen it. I know you've all seen it. There's that jumbo jet on its way to crash into the building. Now that was a fake. That was
yes, the tourist guy. Is
the
his
tourist
name.
Guy. Yeah, yeah, whatever the meme is called, the tourist guy. But I wanted you to both talk about that, because what I think is so interesting is, first of all, how do you understand what that meant, that something like that emerged? But then the second part I want you to talk about is how it morphed. I mean, and you know, the guy appeared in the Hindenburg,
right.
and
JFK.
With the JFK.
Right.
Yep, so with Godzilla.
Godzilla. Start with that first part. Lynn, you start, if you would. Do you understand how that emerged, that meme?
Well, I think it's interesting. It emerged almost as a visual legend. Legend, I would call it, because it was pitched as true. It was put forward the story behind it was some rescue workers had found a camera in the rubble of the World Trade Center buildings, and there was intact film inside it. They had it developed, and this is one of the pictures. And of course, for those who've seen it, he's standing with his back to the city.
Yeah. Smiling at the camera.
Yep, smiling at the camera. And in the air behind him is the plane. And in the bottom, you know, the nice little point of authentication in the bottom corner of the picture has the date, September 11th, 2001. And I think initially this was so striking to people because, fake or not, that was most probably someone's experience. And like any good, heart-wrenching art, this communicated that in a really striking visual way. And I think people's reactions were incredibly visceral.
And everyone shared it.
Oh, everyone shared. And there were debates immediately about whether it was false. Had it been Photoshopped? Could this be real? Of course, the guy's been located. He's alive and well and is now, you know, infamous for this. But I think that initial reaction was so emotional because it was art, folk art, in a sense, and it was good representative art that captured the just the mind-boggling horror of what that moment was.
Something we couldn't make sense of. Yeah. This sort of helped in some way?
Yeah, I think so. I don't even know if it helped so much as it offered an opportunity for expression, for feeling. And we see folklore do that a lot. Folklore doesn't always help as much as it offers a chance to express something or feel something or engage with something. And I think that then the second half of that, Trevor's the humor scholar. He can talk about that, I think, was in response to people were hurt to find out their emotions had been played on so strongly with something that turned out to be false in a way.
Yeah. Trevor, take it from there.
Yeah, I would say that's absolutely the first part is people were really upset that they'd been duped. But I think it also comes down to the fact that this was a very emotionally wretched time for most Americans because of what had happened. The symbolic significance of everything hadn't really sunk in for a lot of people. I think in some cases it still hasn't. I have students from New York here who are still very young, and still it's some of their earliest memories, which is awful. But what we see here with the adaptations after the fact, I think really speaks to the power of folk culture and popular culture coming together, which it does so prolifically online, to create new meaning, to reset the dialogue in a lot of ways. One of the things that we've observed about humor in past circulations of jokes, like after the Challenger disaster and after 9/11, was something called a latency period, or a period of time where no one would really make jokes, where it was not appropriate to make jokes, and people kind of took their time to grieve and try to make some kind of sense out of it on their own terms before you would start to see these things kind of start to circulate. That doesn't happen anymore. We've kind of moved on from that. I've collected jokes after the death of Amy Winehouse, Michael Jackson, and I'm talking within 10, 15 minutes, and sometimes far less than that. I've seen it even less than that. Jokes are going up. Memes are going up. But back to the specific example about 9/11, what we see here is in the subsequent adaptations of what you're referring to is the tourist guy showing up at all these other different moments in visual history and having these other kind of icons from popular culture showing up beside him, where he's showing up as this kind of dubious culprit, perhaps in some kind of hoax or in the disaster itself. So you see the Hindenburg, you see King Kong. And really, these are kind of reflexive in a great deal of the power of how people use cultural analogs to make sense of something in the present. It's much easier to think about the attacks on 9/11 in terms of Die Hard or planes crashing into buildings in terms of War of the Worlds than to actually try to conceptualize in reality that these are real people doing these things to other people. It's much easier to put them in a fictional way that makes light of them. It takes the power away from the pain. And this is, again, another reason why expression through folklore can be so powerful. It can be cathartic. And it can be used through humor to kind of reset the dialogue and change the meaning of a particular text. So instead of being shocked at this particular image for thinking it's real or being stinging from feeling that you've been duped, it can then be an opportunity to kind of mess with that guy's legacy and also have some kind of an opportunity to finally humorously comment on 9/11 where it is basically socially forbidden to do so, especially in those early moments thereafter.
Well, what I like about it is that not only can we be as a people, petty and small-minded, but we're pretty funny. Mm-hmm. We have a sense of humor. I mean, and that's one of the things it seems, Lynn McNeil, that kind of floats to the top is that this sense of irony and wanting to break taboo and laugh at something.
Absolutely. And I think we see that in response to so many things. I mean, really, when it comes to folk expression, the world is our buffet, right? We get to respond to everything we want. There have always been good joke tellers in the world. There have always been, people just ready with the clever quip. And the online community has just sort of expanded their ability to do that. So, we see it. And again, it's really rapid fire, but we see it with things like Mitt Romney's infamous binders full of women quote that just exploded online. I mean, that was a Twitter hashtag, binders full of women. I believe it's a Facebook page. I don't know if it still is, but it was. One of my favorite things to come out of that was the faux Amazon reviews of Avery three-ring binders that were like, it's so wonderful. I can put all my women in one place. And I know Trevor has researched that, so he probably has more to say about that. But it's just, I mean, if we think about the breadth of creativity, the multiplicity of ways that people were able to take what was a news bite, a little sound bite from a debate or an interview, and turn it into this sort of hilarious shared code that people could have. Whether you were for Romney or against Romney was sort of beside the point. It was a showcase in which to be clever, to be creative, to be funny. And we see things like that popping up all the time, popular hashtags or sayings or themes and stuff like that. I know one of the most popular things going around right now, very immediately, is that Courtney Love contributed to the finding of the lost, you know, airplane. Yeah. And so there's sort of like a Courtney's got it covered thing yeah, that's right, emerging. Right. It's a great. It's a great way for people to engage in politics, to engage in popular culture on a genuine folk level, but achieve major broadcasting strength. Yeah.
Lynn McNeil is with us, author of Folklore Rules. It's an introduction to folklore studies. She teaches folklore at Utah State University. And we have Trevor Blank with us, author of the book The Last Laugh, Folk Humor, Celebrity Culture, and Mass-Mediated Disasters in the Digital Age. He teaches at the State University of New York at Potsdam. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
A little pretty white girl ran to a black man's arms. Dad gave away. Dad gave away. My neighbor got big testicles because we see this dude every day. We eat ribs with this dude, but we didn't have a clue that that girl was in that house.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the way we use the internet to express ourselves. A lot of us are fretting about what the digital age is doing to our ability to communicate with each other. And on its face, a lot of the crap we see online seems painfully superficial. Texting and tweeting seems to be too truncated, really, to be meaningful. But our guests today say we might be overreacting a little bit. The form is different, of course, but look, we're social creatures. The memes, the GIFs, the lingo, it's human. We have with us Trevor Blank, author of the book The Last Laugh, Folk Humor, Celebrity Culture, and Mass-Mediated Disasters in the Digital Age. And from USU, Lynn McNeil is with us, author of the book Folklore Rules, An Introduction to Folklore Studies. And let's take a call from Chris, who's in West Valley. Chris, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I was just wondering how you felt about these memes, mostly done as a joke, but if it's often something that perpetuates ignorance more than anything else, where people actually believe it, and then they continue to spread it and instead of verifying things on their own.
That is such a great question. I mean, this idea that yes, they're funny and we perpetuate. But what if there's something that's basically false, that's wrong, that's biased or slanderous in that meme that is making its way exponentially around the world?
You know, I think that is a definite, genuine problem. I think people should fact check. I mean, I think even in very benign ways, we see quotes attributed to people that seem just too good to be true in the way they're tailored to a contemporary event. There were misquotes of Martin Luther King Jr. going around at the Trayvon Martin shooting time and everything. And it really is. It's a dangerous potential for misinformation. I think not to totally sidestep that issue, but it's important to remember that misinformation was rife before the internet, and urban legends, rumors, false information circulates orally without the aid of technology all the time. And so in that sense, we see that speeding up, that expansion of reach, perhaps, of the information. But
we've always done it.
Yeah, it's not a new situation, and the onus has always been on us to fact check our information. And the reality is we have greater tools now. Snopes.com is a great way to debunk anything you hear online. They do their research. They're very, very thorough. So we have more opportunities now, and we rarely take them, just as we have always rarely taken them. We hear news from our family and friends that sounds like news. We pass it on unthinkingly. It's totally false information, and yet we've propagated it. So I don't think that's not a solution to the caller's issue.
Well, everyone has the crazy uncle or the father that, you know, and so you immediately go to Snopes. And as soon as you see the email from your dad,
yep.
No, he's got something a little wrong there. Trevor Blank, you want to say something about that?
Well, as soon as the caller was asking that question, I was thinking about some of these particular image macros that utilize racial stereotypes to try to make some kind of comedic point. The first one that came to my head was overachieving Asian father, which is one where there's often at the top of the meme, there's something about a student, presumably an Asian child, who does something very well. And then the bottom half of it, it is, why didn't you do this better in some kind of a way? It's, you know, I got an A on the test, and why not an A plus? You know, it would be an example of that. And it uses this kind of perpetuates these existing racial stereotypes for humorous purposes. And some would say that that's not necessarily a bad thing because it's a good stereotype, quote unquote. But nevertheless, it is problematic. And it is something that folklorists should not parse through. It's something that folklorists and other scholars of digital culture should not ignore just because it is unsavory or difficult to go through, because these are, like it or not, facets of the greater culture that we're trying to understand. And so having a better grip on what that means, who the target audience is for, are still relatively important, even though it's not always easy to kind of get through that in terms of actual source material itself.
And considering that internet memes and jokes and rumors are often how we round out our understanding of things like politics and the government and current events, these issues affect voting. These issues affect the way we engage, you know, civically. This is, if anyone doubts the significance of folklore, this is it. You know, it shapes how we, there are, you know, the all the legends and rumors that have circulated about Barack Obama affect the way that people see him, and all, you know, political candidates of every spectrum.
Right.
And they're hard to quash. You know, people are devoted oftentimes to misinformation.
But what about trolling, for example, on the internet, for example? I mean, this is something that people think about all the time. If you dare go into the comment section of any blog or any newspaper or whatever, you find it. We can be a pretty nasty sort of, the racism, the vulgarity is pretty remarkable. And so I wanted to get you both to talk a little bit about that, because there's this sense, I think, that people have that I'm anonymous. No one needs to know who I am. Here I am behind this keyboard now, and I can, my true racist, horrid, sexist self can emerge in this stupid, pointless comment I'm making. But Lynn McNeil, you've talked a little bit about this, and you don't quite see it exactly that way, that anonymity doesn't exactly bring out our worst.
Well, it can do a lot of things. I mean, and I think that that's really, if there's an overall, you know, opinion that I have about digital culture, it's really that we can't see it in a black and white way. I mean, anonymity does definitely promote flaming and trolling and things that people would never say face-to-face, or we hope certainly would never say face-to-face to a certain person. But we also see that the fact that you are disembodied online, that you leave yourself behind, gives people some great opportunities to try out different aspects of their personality, to live in a way that they wish they could live in person or face-to-face as sort of a trial round or a testing ground for this. So that anonymity is really a double-edged sword. And I think I think the internet is new enough that we are figuring out what the unspoken rules are. There are already a lot of them. I mean, we already know.
And we call each other on them,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, and we even see it in the simplest sense. For anyone who's a Facebook user, you already know there are like right and wrong ways to use Facebook. Like, we all have that fun aunt who you post a picture and there's a nice comment thread going about the picture, and out of the blue there's your aunt in the comments to that picture being like, are you coming for dinner on Thursday? And
right.
You're like, whoa, that's
right.
Come on. But I think for a long time we've been looking at situations where people are behaving badly and saying the technology is causing people to behave badly. And I think that is one untrue. People are causing people to behave badly, and that we will get to a point where behavior like that will be increasingly shunned. People will be increasingly rejected. We will feel more of a sense of ownership over our online presentation of ourselves, that it will be a little bit more like attacking an individual. And
but we just have to work out this crap.
Yeah, these are growing pains a little bit. You know, people are saying, oh, cell phones have made people so rude. There have always been rude people. And
clueless people.
Yeah, and we work on that, we hope.
Trevor Blank?
I think you both touched on some of the key points. One of the things that comes to mind for me when I think of issues of anonymity online is that this is a concern that was much stronger in the early days of studying the internet, when we're talking about like the Web 1.0 era, when being anonymous was much more inclusive to the entire identity expression of acting out online. Mm. But in a lot of ways, I see that being less and less of an issue as more and more people embrace an online identity that is akin to their offline identity, so that people who go on Facebook do not think of this as necessarily an anonymous form, but rather this is me talking to a group of my friends, and they conceptualize it in their heads the exact same way. Now, of course, when we're talking about forums and things like that on different web pages, trolling kind of takes that to a very different level, because while that is still anonymous, we don't know the person who they are individually, we don't know where they live, we don't know what school they went to, we don't know any of that kind of contextual information we can get from something like Facebook, we nevertheless can sometimes get cues. And I'll give you an example. I'm a big fan of football. I should say American football. I have to clarify. I have students who like soccer. And I tend to go to different kind of football web pages and blogs and forums and things like that to kind of get different kind of information about teams and different things going on, especially now it's free agency. So this one particular one I go to is Pro Football Talk, which is a pretty big one owned by NBC. And there are a couple of different characters on there whose identities are based around the screen name that they've associated with. And they've been so adept at trolling that other users anticipate them commenting on a particular team's webpage. There's a troll for the Redskins. There's a troll for the Vikings. There's a troll for the Steelers. So if there's any post related to the Steelers and you get there before they do, you can say, oh, I know they're going to say something. So even in these cases, these particular cases, the trolls themselves have their own identity, even though they're not necessarily attached all the way to a correlate in the face-to-face communication world. They're nevertheless important to the own community that is established in that particular website. And this happens in a lot of other places too, with other kind of fan sites and football sites and other sports types. But this is just one example. I know it happens in many others, where just because someone doesn't have a name doesn't mean that they don't have an identity. It just may be a little bit differently constructed in the way that we've traditionally associated the concept of identity when it comes to cultural expression.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of scholars have looked sort of to see whether or not we can have what we might call real community or a genuine community online, and they've looked for, okay, so what are the markers of a community? What makes a group of people not just a group but a community? And one of the markers is often an awareness of roles, so that, you know, among a neighborhood or a church group or anything we might easily call a community, we can say, oh, so and so's the jokester, and you know, so and so's sort of the leader and takes charge when things are needed, and that's that same thing that Trevor's talking about online, in a sense, having, oh, that guy's always the instigator. If it's a cohesive sort of community that regularly interacts, that's actually reinforcing rather than disintegrating that
sense.
But
one thing I think is interesting about this idea of community, when we go to a place where Trevor Blank goes to the football places and other people go to Star Wars sites and other people are truckers and, you know, they have this natural gathering place. That's obviously a lot of people talk about. This is one of the good things about the internet. People of like mind can gather. But in face-to-face communities and that sort of in our real analog lives, we probably shouldn't just do that. We shouldn't just gather in communities of people who think, because it makes us better people, doesn't it, to be able to have to interact with the guy who doesn't have a clue about Star Trek or who doesn't agree with me politically, those kinds of things. Do you know what I mean? In that sense, do you worry that the internet is in fact isolating us, at least in the analog way?
I think in some ways there is that risk, but it's more minimal than that. And I think because largely very few people are that one-dimensional. And what ends up happening, it goes beyond, I'm a member of many different web forums, and what it becomes is, and lots of really fun in-depth studies of web communities have shown this, is a group of folks will get together to talk about Star Trek or Buffy or something like that, and what they talk about is everything.
Yeah.
And they talk about their lives, and there's a forum for general discussion, and someone shows up and they join that forum because they like Star Trek. And what they end up doing there is talking about their problems at work or their struggles with their siblings, and they get communion, they get support, they get advice. And there are forums designed for that. I've had students write papers on cancer support forums where people feel for the first time they can talk with people who really get what they're talking about. But even in forums devoted to sports and pop culture, we see genuine topics, genuine, you know, way out of the purview of the stated goal of that forum. They just emerge. They come into being. We can't stop that from happening. Forum moderators know you have to create, you know, general talk or the coffee shop or the kitchen table, you know, whatever we name those forums.
Because we're humans and
yeah,
we need that.
And you can't stop people yeah. from doing that. And if I feel an affinity with you because we like the same sports team, maybe when we're chatting, I'm going to bring up the other aspects of my life.
Lynn McNeil is with us, teaches at Utah State University, author of the book Folklore Rules. Trevor Blank, also with us, teaches at SUNY Potsdam in New York. Among his books is The Last Laugh, and we need to take another quick break. We'll come back for some final thoughts in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the way we express ourselves online. It's also a conversation about digital folklore. We have with us Lynn McNeil, who teaches at Utah State University, Trevor Blank, who teaches at SUNY Potsdam in New York. So I think you're getting a lot of pushback from the digital immigrants, you know, the non-natives to the digital age, who are worried about these abbreviated forms of communication, like Twitter is one. And text, you know, texts are usually truncated. They're not, you know, I know a lot of people worry about punctuation and spelling and, you know, proper grammar, all those kinds of things in these ways that we express ourselves these days. What do you make of that, Lynn McNeil? Again, we're destroying the English language or whatever language.
I think there are two sort of issues here. One, there's the sort of linguistic grammar issue. And what I would say to that, and other studies have borne this out, is that we have always had multiple modes of speaking. And that has, I mean, we've always known that. It's called, you know, rhetorical awareness, right? Like, I speak one way with my friends and another way with my parents, yeah. not to be disingenuous, but because those are two different folk groups, two different folk cultures that I have in my life. And people who are, you know, capable and intelligent have always been able to navigate that. It would sound strange if perhaps you spoke the same way you did at work when you're hanging out with your friends at a restaurant, because we always adapt ourselves to our situation. So people have always been able to speak in slang and write an essay in formal English. And people have always been better and worse at that. And the ability, I think, to use a very particular vernacular in text messages does not limit our ability to then know how to write an essay. It's the offline equivalent of someone who speaks in slang not knowing that there's a proper English to use when writing an essay. And so I think that's an overblown concern. I do not believe that texting is ruining our abilities to speak any more than any vernacular way of speaking has. But I think the emotional thing is much more interesting to me, because I hear a lot of people saying that, you know, oh, we have to condense all our big emotional talks with our family down into 160 characters now for text messages. And I think that we live in this fear that technology is replacing other modes of communication, and we really need to see it as
adding to.
Huh. Exactly. I had a student who quite wonderfully told me a story of how when her kids were young, she would always put a little post-it note in their lunchboxes telling, you know, with something about how she loved them. And she kind of said, you know, now that post-it note was not the appropriate venue to address big, serious family issues like we might be moving next year or your father and I are thinking of getting a divorce. You don't write your father and I are thinking of getting a divorce on a post-it note and stick it in your fourth grader's lunch bag, right? But it was one mode of communication that was a drop-in reminder of, hey, I love you, pick up that form at the office today. And she said that now that her children are adults and out of the house, that's what text messaging is. It's a note in a lunchbox that she can send to her adult son who lives three states away that says, hey, don't forget to call grandma on her birthday. I love you. And that is a beautiful addition to our repertoire of communicative venues.
Trevor Blank, what do you think?
Yeah, I would add to those lovely descriptions of that Lynn has put forth. One of the things I've seen is really kind of how text messaging has affected spoken language and spoken expression. So, for example, whenever I know I do this, and I know many other people do this, when they see something mildly amusing, they go, lol. and say LOL out loud for laugh out loud, which has been an internet-derived initialism that was supposed to express laughter. So I hear LOL all the time. You hear OMG all the time for oh my God, which oftentimes has been abbreviated in online circles as well. Or I've seen people even say out loud emoticons like winky face when they're trying to make some kind of expression to themselves to kind of illustrate this kind of point. It's meant to be playful, and people are aware that this is derived from a digitized space. And this, again, speaks to this hybridization of folk culture that I was mentioning before. It sounds like kind of a clunky concept, but when you think of it that way, you can see what I mean by hybrid. It's bringing in these different kind of dimensions and mashing them together in both different domains. So we get face-to-face characteristics online, and we get online characteristics in face-to-face. It seems kind of antithetical, but it does work out that way. Now, there are some scholars who disagree with kind of our idea out there. I know Sherry Turkle has done work on Alone Together. This is kind of this concept that we are paradoxically alone while we are together with other people online. And in the past, Robert Putnam has done Bowling Alone, which came out in, I think, 1999, 2000, around there, about how, you know, civic engagement is going way down as technology increases and people are becoming more physically isolated. Well, I think that's kind of a misnomer, because when you see physical isolation doesn't necessarily mean cognitive isolation. And that's really kind of where there is some important developments going on. We're seeing these different kind of ways that people interact in meaningful ways. It just happens to be changing at generational rates in some capacities, where text messaging can take on new meaning in ways that it didn't before.
It's Trevor Blank, teaches at SUNY Potsdam in New York. Among his books is The Last Laugh: Folk Humor, Celebrity Culture, and Mass-Mediated Disasters in the Digital Age. Trevor, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Lynn McNeil, teaches at Utah State University, the author of Folklore Rules. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond, technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.